Welcome to CFRI's Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
So, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for the opportunity to present here today. I'm very excited and very grateful for the chance to speak to you. As mentioned, my name is Tracy Kazmierski. I'm from Pittsburgh, and I do have a few disclosures to put out there. One is that I am a consultant for and I receive research grant support from the CF Foundation, as well as research support from the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute. And while we're at it, I have a few more disclaimers. So I am indeed a pulmonologist, and I am not a sexual and reproductive health specialist. And I don't have a strong desire to turn pulmonologists into sexual and reproductive health specialists. I'm a pediatric pulmonologist, so you're going to see a heavy focus on adolescents and young adults in this talk. And you're also going to see a heavy focus on women, because at this point, I research the sexual and reproductive health care optimization for women with CF. And I'll talk a little bit about why that is, but we'll also include issues for men with CF from a clinical perspective here today. So my real hope today is that you leave this talk with more knowledge on sexual and reproductive health of men and women with CF, and how to improve this aspect of care and partner with patients, with families, and with your care teams around making this part of care better. So I wanted to kind of start here with, you know, why do we care? And adolescents and young adults with CF really view sexual and reproductive health as key to their emerging adulthood and comprehensive care. Sexual and reproductive health decisions are often the first thing that people truly seek independently from caregivers or family members, whether that be through obtaining birth control, STI testing, pregnancy testing, or just general care. And a vital part of adulting truly is sexual and reproductive health. As survival increases, more and more people are starting to face sexual and reproductive health decisions. And certainly that is extending throughout the entire life course. And when we think about women, I often say from menstruation to menopause. So I'll bring it up now, why women? The interplay between female sex hormones, so estrogen and progesterone, and CF physiology has been demonstrated, but is not clearly understood. We know that specifically estrogen has negative effects on infection, inflammation, and mucociliary clearance. And clinically, we've shown that CF disease outcomes do worsen after puberty for women with CF compared to men. And potentially, women with CF experience early perimenopausal symptoms and have associated negative effects on CF health. This really ties into what we've seen from a natural history perspective, which is that while we have continued increased survival, there is still a gender gap, with women living on average 3 years shorter than men, but taking into account that women on average live about 4 years longer than men, kind of that net of 7 years is truly significant. In more recent studies from the Canadian registry, we found that females have a higher risk of death before age 30 compared to males, and this is adjusting for nutritional status, for their microbiology, and for lung function. And a clear understanding of how female sex hormones contribute to this gap and what we can do about it is still lacking and under research. So I just want to do a quick landscape of what I'm going to talk about today. For women with CF, there's a wide range of CF-specific issues that are faced, anywhere from delayed puberty, worsening symptoms during the menstrual cycle, all the way up through parenthood decision making. And for men with CF, some similar things overlap. Unfortunately, I'm not going to have time to go through all of this, and I'm certainly not going to have time to go through things in detail. So I welcome your questions at the end. But these are the things that I really did want to focus on today. So urinary incontinence, we are gonna talk about incontinence this weekend. Sexual functioning concerns, issues with contraceptive choice, fertility, pregnancy, and parenthood. And then similarly for men, urinary incontinence, sexual functioning, fertility, and parenthood decisions. So I like this picture, everybody, and it looks so horribly uncomfortable. When you're a teenager, a lot of things feel horribly uncomfortable. And I often view this picture through the eyes of the woman in it and how nervous she looks. But I think both of them look not super at ease. And I think it may be because they're wondering how the date's gonna go. But I do think that maybe it is their concern. Maybe they're about to see a very funny movie. And when you laugh really hard, sometimes things happen. So urinary incontinence. The prevalence of urinary incontinence is higher in women than men with CF. However, it does occur in both. And the data that we have out there is really all over the place. So you're gonna see these big ranges of 16% to 76% of women and 5 to 15% of men. The common triggers that have been identified do include laughing, coughing, sneezing, physical activity, airway clearance, and PFTs themselves. Older studies have shown that it can interfere with CF management, with adolescent girls being more reticent to do airway clearance because of this concern. Personal embarrassment and worry, and inhibition of social and intimate activities. What we've seen as we look through all the data around urinary incontinence, there's been no hard evidence to show that once your FEV1 drops to a certain percent, then you're sick enough to get urinary incontinence. It's kind of all across the board. So when we think about it, it's really something that everybody should be screened for starting in childhood. A lot of people who experience urinary incontinence had that start before they were 12. And thinking through other causes, if you're seeing somebody who has this issue, or if one of your loved ones or you yourself are having it, it's really important to rule out UTIs or urinary tract infections. Not diagnosed or poorly controlled CF-related diabetes, and then treating any constipation because the bowel and bladder are so connected that often that can worsen urinary incontinence or cause it. One of the first steps that we do at our center is we will refer to physical therapy for pelvic floor strengthening, and I'll add core exercises. But again, urology or urogynecology referrals may indeed be appropriate. And this is one of those issues that really we need more research on to further define the prevalence and certainly to look through treatment options and what we're, if we're targeting the right interventions that are gonna make a difference. So when I started out doing this research, I had a provider tell me, oh, they're too sick to have sex. So that's not true. But I think that it was important that we actually went about and proved that. So we did a study a couple years ago of 15 to 24-year-old young women with CF from 5 different centers across the US. And we looked at their data around their sexual and reproductive health experiences and compared it to the general US population data. And we found that women with CF engage in the same types of sexual behaviors and activities with similar age of sexual debut, rates, and similar numbers of partners. So this idea that you're too sick is not the case. There are, however, significant issues around sexual functioning in CF. Anecdotally, this has been thought about in the past. In the survey that I just talked about, we found that a third of women that we surveyed experienced vaginal pain, we think possibly due to thick cervical mucus and vaginal dryness, but we're not sure. A third had coughing during or after sex half the time or more. Smaller numbers, 2%, 3%, had hemoptysis or excessive flatulence. And when we used a validated sexual dysfunction tool, We found that one out of six of the 15 to 24-year-old women actually had diagnosable sexual functioning issues. In studies with men, we found that they often have decreased ejaculate volume, which can cause them kind of personal worry or embarrassment, and sometimes partners can recognize that as well. And one step that I think is pertinent to take is reassurance that these issues are common. And some practical tips include good communication with one's partner, use of short-acting bronchodilators and airway clearance 20 to 30 minutes before any sexual activity, and trial of sexual positions that require less energy and decreased pressure on the chest. And this is also one of those things that we really do need to think about more and research more. Sexually transmitted infections and cervical screening. When we looked at the 15 to 24-year-old women in the sample and compared it to the general population, we found that they were significantly less likely to have ever been tested for STIs, to have ever had a pap smear or pelvic exam, and that less than half reported obtaining the HPV vaccine. In a older study of men with CF, we found that it was found that one in three men with CF assumed that they didn't need to use condoms during adolescence, which is driven by the fertility issues, but truly doesn't do anything for protecting against STIs. A more recent French study of adult women with CF found that approximately one out of four lacked regular gynecologic follow-up, and only 55% reported a previous pap smear in their entire life. This is adult women. So why is cervical screening so important? As this audience knows, people with CF can be considered for organ transplantation, and it's known that immunosuppression is associated with a heightened risk of cervical dysplasia. Some French data has also come out that has shown that just in general, women with CF may be at increased risk of cervical dysplasia, and that needs to be further investigated. But really assessing from the CF team, patient access to gynecologic services and receipt of that HPV vaccine is crucial to preventing this long term. So birth control or contraception. There's a lot of things to consider when considering what type of birth control is appropriate for a woman with CF. There's several medication interactions with antibiotics and certain modulators. There's CF-related liver disease that you'd really want to avoid some hormonal form, CF-related diabetes control, bone health, and whether or not you have a port or other implantable vascular access devices. I'm not going to go into this in detail, because I think this is actually what's important. The most effective contraception is the one that a woman actually uses. So whatever choice a patient and a caregiver make together really has to align with a woman's priorities. And I think that does require some work on our part as providers, as well as on patients, to understand what those priorities are. So my birth control is a decision aid that's put out in part by Planned Parenthood, but also in partnership with an organization called Bedsider.org, which is a great educational resource for sexual and reproductive health. But you know, this is an app and a decision aid that really helps walk through what are your priorities around the type of birth control that you want and what you would feel comfortable with. It is not CF specific. So it really aligns with your priorities around if you want something effective, if you want something easy, and those type of things. But it is a place to start. And especially a place to start when you're having discussions with your CF team and with your women's health providers. Again, this is something that I think just should be put up on a slide, and we'll sit with it for a second. Most women with CF are fertile. In 2015, there were 235 pregnancies in U.S. women with CF. And while that rate is reduced compared to the general population, it truly continues to climb. Why the rate is reduced is, again, not fully understood. The biggest thing that people say is, well, there's thicker cervical mucus without normal cyclical variation, meaning that it's just more difficult to achieve fertilization and implantation. There's also some altered bicarbonate transport that leads to suboptimal sperm capacitation. Also issues, obviously, with fertilization, if that's the case. And there's been some data. We did a case report several years ago of a woman who had a partner for years. They had had unprotected sex for years. She went on to Kalydeco, and she got pregnant 3 months later. So whether CFTR modulators are indeed thinning out cervical mucus, improving that bicarbonate transport, or what other issues that they're correcting, if that is going to even increase this pregnancy rate even more. Over 97% of men with CF are infertile. This is due to congenital absence of the vas deferens. And I will say that I have this group of little baby boys that I'm taking care of right now. I think I have like three or four who are under the age of one. And this is something that I bring up very early with their parents. And I bring this up and I say why, and I say this number, and then I say this, that they are candidates for assisted reproductive technology. And that I do that on purpose because I think that one of my mentors had told me that one of the first questions he got from parents often, after he gave the diagnosis of CF thousands of times, was, will I be a grandparent someday? Which I think is inlaid with a bunch of different things, like a survival question and an expectation for what people can expect for their lives. But it's also a very real question around fertility. So I try to bring that up early and repeat it, not every visit, but certainly bring it up so that message gets through. It also brings up the question of, can we administer these CFTR modulators in utero to really prevent some of these things from occurring, including prevent kind of the involution of the vas deferens from occurring in the beginning? And I think that's something that we should think about and that may come down the line. So these are some numbers. 78% of women and 84% of young men in two separate surveys, obviously several years apart, stated that they desired future children. And this number continues to kind of grow, and it's probably very close to national numbers. So if you ask a teenager when they're 17, a boy or a girl, would you want to have kids someday? I don't think that there's going to be a big difference between someone who has CF and someone who doesn't looking forward into the future. And there's many options as to the path to parenthood. One obvious one is through pregnancy. And I know that, you know, we are like a broken record when we think about pregnancy and CF because we say it's best to plan, it needs to be planned. And the reason that that's said is because of underlying chronic disease and the medications and the risk for increased pulmonary exacerbations, the women with CF who become pregnant are considered high risk and should be seen by a multidisciplinary care team with CF team members as well as women's health providers. I'm not going to go through all the data around pregnancy. I will say that more data and more research is needed around how pregnancy and CF interact with each other, and how pregnancy affects CF and how CF affects pregnancy and what that really looks like long term. What we do know from some registry data is that survival doesn't seem to be impacted by pregnancy. We also have seen that women who become pregnant have increased clinic visits, which I think makes some sense. And they also have an increased rate of exacerbations and treatment for exacerbations during their pregnancy. I'm happy to say that the CF Foundation recently funded a study to look at pregnancy outcomes on a broader scale, not just from a single center, to really see what the trajectory is before and after pregnancy, and then specifically looking forward what modulators effect on pregnancy is. The modulator question has also and is currently being explored by Dr. Taylor Kauser out of National Jewish and some partners in the United Kingdom. And they've really, while the numbers are small, I think that the safest thing to say is that it does not seem that modulators cause increased infant mortality or huge birth defects, like some in the audience may remember with the thalidomide issue many, many years ago. But really, in general and long term, when to stay on modulators, when to go off, and what the guidelines really are, we just need more data and more time. But needless to say, more and more people with CF are considering pregnancy, so it's really important to assess that. So this group, Power to Decide, came up with this idea of one key question. And this is an attempt to provide a framework for health providers who support women ages 18 to 50 to routinely ask, would you like to become pregnant in the next year? And it's kind of that one question that opens the gate and guides where you're going to go from there. And I would ask, is this right for CF? And I've thought about this a lot, and I think that this question is too limiting for several reasons. One is, pregnancy is not the only path to parenthood. And two is, it also, we'd want to include men in this question. So I think that this is the better question. Would you like to become a parent in the next year? I marked this out just so we can talk through it. So yes, I'd like to be a parent in the next year. I think the next question would be, would you or your partner like to become pregnant? If the answer is yes, it's really going down to preconception care. If you're a man with CF, really looking through what the options are for assisted reproductive technology. If you're a woman, really planning out what medications you need to adjust, what your care needs to look like, thinking through your support system, those kind of things. And if the answer is no, thinking through the other options for parenthood, such as adoption, surrogacy, or foster care, is important to consider and have that conversation with our families and our patients. Surrogacy laws and the foster care system looks vastly different depending on what state that you're in. So really being kind of up as a CF care team as to, you know, what state you're in, what that looks like, and really being able to provide some resources, I think, going forward is going to become more and more important. If someone would not like to become a parent in the next year, if they're having sex, it is appropriate to make sure that we're doing some contraceptive counseling and thinking through what options align with their priorities and what options align with kind of what's safe in regards to their medications and other comorbidities. And then I included the last statement, which is not sure. And I think that as healthcare providers, the trap that we often fall in is like, oh my God, how can you not be sure? Like, we need to plan this. Why isn't this something that you've thought about? Why isn't this black and white? And it can be very frustrating. But I think that in the general population, this idea of ambivalence around specifically pregnancy in women has started to become more and more well documented. People say things like, I know that there was one study from one of my mentors that showed, well, I'm not trying to get pregnant, or whatever happens. And I think that often this decision about parenthood is just such a life-altering one that we really need to be thoughtful that some people are approaching that in a different way than we ourselves may. And I think that the best question to ask is, how can we support you in this decision? I think also embedded into this not sure is that some people with CF and some people in general feel like it's not something that they can control whether or not they're pregnant in the next year. Because they have concerns about fertility, because maybe they're in a situation where, you know, they're experiencing some reproductive coercion and their partner won't let them use birth control or makes them use birth control. So I think that really making sure that we're not missing anything on that realm is also really important. So how do we fix this? I'm a health services researcher by training, so this has always been kind of what I had focused on, which is we know there's some issues. How do we transform care to deliver this care, but also make sure that it's an efficient and effective solution for all involved? When we first started out, I did some interviews, and Susan Sawyer from Australia did some surveys with men, and we had found that there were two big themes. One is that people wanted sexual and reproductive health educational resources. But it was very clear, at least in the interviews that I did, that that wasn't going to be enough. People want tailored discussions around sexual and reproductive health with CF providers. So in thinking through the educational resources part, I was able to partner with women with CF, parents of young women with CF, adolescent medicine providers, and CF team members. And we partnered with the Center for Young Women's Health out of Boston Children's, which runs a wonderful website for anyone, not CF specific. And we created, with their help, 12 CF specific sexual and reproductive health guides for teen and young adult women. So these are appropriate for girls age 12 and up. They hit through a range of topics, really starting at the general, what is CF, and then go from puberty and periods all the way through talking to your team and your partner. They're organized, every guide on the website, of which there's hundreds in general, are organized by frequently asked questions. So you can see here that, you know, that's kind of the layout of what you see. They're available online, you can print them, they're free. And you can access all of them at once by going to this website. When we partnered with the stakeholders that helped develop these, it was really important to them, and I think that this was really key, to include these kind of phrases to use to bring this topic up with your doctor and your CF team. Because we as CF providers, which I'll show in a second, aren't that great about bringing this up. So sometimes, you know, having the vocabulary to say, this is what I'm concerned about, can you refer me to someone, is really helpful. There are other resources for adults with CF, and there's a bevy of them on the CF Foundation's website around reproductive health and fertility, as well as around family planning. But these are geared to an older audience, and often an audience that's really kind of more advanced and more mature in how they're thinking through their reproductive goals. In regards to these discussions with CF providers, I really wanted to know how we were doing as a team, and what our patients and families were hearing. And I certainly wasn't the first person to think about this. Doctors Catherine Freeman and Susan Sawyer from Australia have really been, especially Dr. Sawyer, has really been a pioneer in the sexual and reproductive health of people with CF. And they laid out a plan for how this should go and really put the CF care team right in the middle as a broker and a key educator around all these issues, really starting at birth with parents and at puberty with patients. When we did a national provider survey several years ago, we asked U.S. CF physicians, physician's assistants, and nurse practitioners what they felt about sexual and reproductive health care for young women with CF. And the majority found that, yeah, this is really important, and it should be standardized in CF care. But when we dug down a little bit, we saw that there were major discrepancies between how important people felt it was to discuss and then how often they routinely addressed it with their patients and families. So for instance, 90% of all the people surveyed felt that pregnancy was important to talk about, but only 63% routinely discussed it. When we broke it down farther into people who took care of pediatric patients versus adults with CF, we found that pediatric providers were less likely to feel things were important and much less likely to ever discuss these things. So meeting men's preferences. Susan Sawyer did a series of surveys with men with CF, and these are the big take-home points around how they're receiving this information and how they feel about it. They heard about infertility later than they desired, and often that was met with a lot of frustration, anger, and sadness. They desire early discussions in the pediatric setting around infertility, and the routine offering of semen analysis in the teenage years. And this is something that I can speak for my center that we don't have standardized. And I think that obviously needs more work to really flush through exactly what the preferences are and how we can make some systems-based change to meet them. The one question that has often plagued me is a lot of people will say, I want this to come from the CF team. But there's a lot of people on a CF team, both required members per the CF Foundation and then kind of recommended team members. So in the survey of 15 to 24-year-old young women, I actually asked this question, who do you want to talk to? If they selected they wanted to talk to the CF team, who is it? And in that survey, 83% of female patients prefer to have discussions with their CF physician and peer PA. And they could select multiple options. So you can see about a quarter said they also would prefer to talk to a nurse. And one out of five nearly wanted to talk to a social worker. But I don't think it's the right thing to do to say, oh, well, the doctor has to talk about it, or the, NP or PA. Because when we've done some qualitative work and some interviews, we've really found that this is very patient-dependent, it's very topic-dependent, and it probably varies a lot. And as one patient said to me, the patient really should have the control to decide. So how do we actually do that? So creating the space. So this is what I talk about a lot. I guess a better way to say it instead of kicking people out is asking others to leave in a kind, effective way. What we found from that survey and what has been found in other surveys is that people, especially teenagers and young adults, want to talk alone, so they don't want anybody else in the room. And they want their providers to initiate these conversations. And I will take a pause here and say, this is my pediatric provider coming out. This is why self-visits starting in the teenage years are so crucial. It's not just to build their ability to recite their medication list or talk about adherence. It's really to allow them the ability to say, you are my doctor, I can bring you issues that I do not feel the need to talk with my parents about or my guardians. And I think self-visits are a great way to start to broach some of these issues, whether it be with a 12-year-old. Obviously, you're not going to have the conversation about all the options for parenthood with a 12-year-old right away, but I think the understanding that they should know that they're fertile and that urinary incontinence should be screened for and other things like yeast infection should be brought up. So that's my plug for self-visits. And I also want to bring out this idea of part of the routine. So in the first qualitative work that I did, I had a young adult woman with CF say this to me. So honestly, start sexual and reproductive health discussions young and have it be an expectation. We walk in here and know that people are going to talk to us about bowel movements. That's just part of what we know is going to be asked. So start these discussions at a young age, and it becomes part of the routine. So I often will advise people to start with figuring out what somebody knows. I once went into a room and I said, I was consenting somebody for a bronchoscopy, and I went through my spiel and I did the thing, And then I found out that this person had had 6 bronchoscopies before, and we had just wasted each other's time for about 15 minutes. So I think that it's really important to start with figuring out what someone knows and where they're at. So have you ever thought about X, Y, or Z? Have you ever heard about this with people with CF? Because this is a sensitive topic, and depending on what aspect of sexual and reproductive health care you're talking about, could be more sensitive than others. But the normalization of this for people with CF is important. A lot of people with CF have this. Is this something that you've experienced? And I think when dealing with teenagers, those of us who are pediatrics trained may recognize what I'm about to put up. A lot of people your age are, and I'll use juuling or use of electronic cigarettes and vaping as an issue. A lot of people your age are using it or juuling. What's going on at your school? Are people juuling at your school? What about your friends? What about you? And I think if you approach it with that normalization behavior, I ask all my patients about juuling, and I found that you have to use the word juul because sometimes they say that, oh, I don't vape. No, no, no. I don't use e-cigarettes. No, no, no. And then you ask about juuling, and they're like, oh, yeah. Yeah, I do use a juul. But I think approaching it in this way, like recognizing this is something that's going on, people at school are doing it, your friends may be doing it, are you doing it, is really a way to go about that with a young person. I've had a provider say to me in an interview, I don't ask those questions because I don't know how to get out of that rabbit hole. And other people have described it as, I don't want to open Pandora's box. And often I'll ask a bunch of questions and then the answer that I come up with is, gee, I don't know. So I think that the identification of partners who do know and can participate in a dialogue with you, and really importantly, people who you can have a conversation with, who you can teach about CF or who understand CF, are really vital. And those can include high-risk OB or maternal fetal medicine, family planning or gynecologic services, fertility specialists, adolescent medicine, urogynecology or urology, and genetic counseling. And then I think that there are systems-level changes that we as a CF care team can make and a hospital system can make. I think that some screeners around specific sexual and reproductive health issues can be really helpful, including urinary incontinence screeners, screening whether or not people are interested in talking about certain conditions at a visit is something that we can certainly think through on a center-by-center basis and also more broadly. How to distribute evidence-based, kind of vetted educational resources, such as from the CF Foundation or the Center for Young Women's Health. To use the champions that you have on your CF care team. So not everybody on a CF team is gonna be comfortable talking about sexual and reproductive health. And that's why I said right at the beginning, the goal is not to make everybody a specialist in this, but really to figure out where your care team is at and who can kind of take the lead role in making sure this is screened for or asked for, making sure this is addressed. And then finally, the development and use of effective evidence-based tools and interventions that can open the door for this conversation and get people access to care and access to good resources and providers. So I'm going to end soon, but I will say there's a lot more that we need to answer, and there is more that we're doing. So we're about halfway through a 10-site survey of older women, I say older in quotes, 25 years and older, so really taking up where we left off, and 25 up, around sexual and reproductive health issues, and really asking about menstruation to menopause, including asking about some of the questions that anecdotally we hear about, like my symptoms are much worse around my period, or I cough, or I'm sick every time I get my period. So really put a number of how many women does that actually happen to, and in what part of your cycle are you in, and what have you done for it? And really asking the menopause questions on a bigger scale. So our goal is 500 women. As of when I left Pittsburgh yesterday, we were at 250, so we're really close to halfway there. And we're going to start looking through that data more thoughtfully and seeing what we're going to find. And then the main work that I'm doing right now is actually around helping women with CF make that decision around their reproductive goals. Meaning, do I want to be a parent? Do I want to be pregnant? And if it's appropriate, what kind of birth control should I be on? And how do I make that choice? And using that as a tool to improve kind of the shared decision making around these topics with your CF team. And as women in the formative research have said, developing a real conversation starter to have these discussions and be thoughtful about a plan if people are at that point. I mentioned one study that was recently funded around looking at pregnancy outcomes for women with CF, which we're very excited about, as well as the influence of modulators on pregnancy. And another study that's been funded is looking at contraceptive safety and effectiveness and looking at that interaction with modulators as well. So there's a lot of promising work that is underway and funded and coming down the line. So this is Julia Child. If anybody has ever heard me speak, I use this slide because this is what it actually looked like underneath her little counter. There's a lot of people behind the scenes, and there's a lot of people that I feel very indebted to. My mentors are not actually named on this slide, but I will name them, Drs. Elizabeth Miller, Sonia Barrero, and Greg Sawicki. And then the CF Reproductive and Sexual Health Collaborative is a partnership between patients, clinicians, and researchers that really has looked at reproductive and sexual health and shed a lot of light on this issue, which has been wonderful. The Center for Young Women's Health, which we partnered with on creating the educational guides for women and hope to do so in the future for young men with CF. And then the CF Foundation, who has continually funded my research around sexual and reproductive health for now 6 years and counting. So I am going to stop there and take any questions that anybody has. And again, thank you so much.
Very interesting. I needed you 6 months ago. As friends know, my daughter is just entering her third trimester.
Wonderful. Congratulations.
She was on the triple because she was part of the study, and I said, aha, it works.
Awesome. Okay.
So my question, though, is in the third trimester and also during labor and delivery, what CF-related issues should she look at, be aware of, that maybe her providers aren't?
Yeah, I think this is a really hard question because the big answer is, like, we're not 100% sure what exactly is happening. I can tell you, and this is because I have two sons, not because I'm a OB-GYN, but it gets, you breathe fast and you breathe hard and it gets, you're getting bigger. So I think that you know, she's really, my advice would be to really stay on top of her treatments as much as she can. She's going to be tired. And airway clearance is going to be really paramount. And really coming through and being very communicative with her CF team as well as her OB around what we're going to be expecting in delivery. And if she's in labor for 15 hours, what does that mean for her treatments? And how do we, like, really actually opening the door to have those conversations very early, not so early, but early and often to see what it's going to look like. And I think, you know, I've had, when we've been developing this decision aid, we did some focus groups to kind of see what people's experience were, especially around if you had been pregnant or had had some sexual and reproductive health concerns, like, what was that like? And women often will describe that experience as, I feel like a middleman in my healthcare. So logistically, they have to organize all their subspecialist appointments. Communication-wise, they have to take their basically their verbal medical history and deliver it to somebody. They also have to teach somebody sometimes who doesn't know anything about CF, like, no, actually, like, I had one woman say, no, it's actually not that weird that I'm alive. Like, we'll start there, which is, you know, somewhat funny, but somewhat devastating. And then finally, to be able to balance these confusing and conflicting pieces of advice that often occur, like you should never get pregnant versus it'll probably be okay, and what the real answer is. So I think that, you know, the best advice is to open the door for communication and be as forceful as an advocate as she can be for herself. That's good. You're welcome.
Thank you so much for your talk. I have a question and a comment. You said that 97% of men were infertile. Do you have that divided out by severe and mild mutations or divided out in any way?
I don't, and I didn't pull that data. So I would be, I don't want to misrepresent anything to say anything specific about that. So.
And then the comment is that, so I have a young adult son with CF, and I'm also a pediatrician. Wonderful. So in my mind, the best time to present that information is at age 10. At age 10 is when, in the United States, in most schools, at least here in California, is when they have that conversation mm-hmm. in school. So that's actually when I had that conversation with my son, mm-hmm. showing him pictures, explaining him to him that yes, he could have children, mm-hmm. but that the vas deferens was blocked, and also explaining to him that he would have a small ejaculate and that he would not have, you know, wet dreams, so he wouldn't later become anxious about these things. Right. And so I think it should be done at age 10, mm-hmm. and I also think that it should be done because it's such a young age with the parents, so that mm-hmm. the parent knows what you told the child, mm-hmm. and they also learn in the process. So.
Absolutely. There are somebody in Australia, if they're listening, is just clapping ecstatically, because that is exactly what they laid out, is really around age 10 or 11, I think, in that plan. Having conversations with parents beforehand, bringing in the young man around that age, and making sure that it was coming from both the provider and the parent. And I think that that's really key, and something that we really need to be thoughtful about as a CF team. You don't want to spring that on parents, that, oh, I'm kicking you out, and by the way, I'm going to break it to your son that they're infertile, is not a good way forward. So I think that being really thoughtful and having parental involvement is really, really important. Dr. Sawyer also asked young men in one of those surveys, I'm blanking on which year it was, who they want to hear it from, and a lot of them said their parents. So I think it's really important that we partner together to have those conversations and have them in a timely fashion. Thank you.
Thanks for bringing this topic to the forefront. As an adult with CF, this is an area I feel very under-supported. And so this is one of the only areas where I've actually get information on reproductive care is at this conference. I'd say my experience is the CF team says, talk to your gynecologist, and then the gynecologist is, I literally had their like, wow, you're alive. Yeah. And that's as far as that's as much as they know about CF, mm-hmm. is they don't expect to have adult patients. So I guess my question though is, your slide about most women with CF are fertile, has that actually been studied? Because I've been diagnosed with infertility, and it's mm-hmm. been assumed CF is the reason I can't mm-hmm. have children. And I've looked desperately for data on this to see if that is the actual reason I can't have children. So I'm curious where that statement came from.
So I think that you're right. There is no hard data that you know, like men, we can clearly say 97% have congenital absence of the vas deferens. That's a clear cause of infertility, so that's very clear. For women, it's not so straightforward, and that's part of what we're trying to accomplish in this survey, is asking women, have you ever been told you're infertile? Have you ever been told it's because of your CF? And while that's not the cleanest way forward, I think it's at least a start to really get a sense of how many people are experiencing infertility, and of people who became pregnant, how many people required assistance with that, whether that be fertility drugs, whether it be IVF, and what really is driving that. So I think that the short answer to your question is, no, we do not have hard data. However, it is a safe assumption for a teenager who's about to, or a young adult who's thinking about having sex, to make the assumption that you are indeed fertile, because it's not something that you want to be surprised by. But this is one of those situations that hopefully in 5 years from now or 10 years from now, we're able to present a lot more data and a lot more evidence around these issues, which is not super helpful for someone who's looking at these decisions and thinking through their reproductive goals now, but I think is important.